There's an inspiring Aussie advocate for mental health who's coming to Murray Bridge later this month to speak at a Ski for Life event about his personal struggle with a mood disorder as a teenager and his experience losing a brother to suicide. We do obviously speak about suicide in this interview for the next 10 minutes, so beware. It could be distressing to some listeners, but I do hope it offers some help as well. Nick Newling is his name. Here he is sharing his story.
I was someone who wanted to be a vet when I was a lot younger and had really high ambitions to do well in school and get a good result in the HSC and go to uni and all these sorts of things. And I was really well supported by my family. They're just wonderful people and just endlessly supportive of me and what I wanted to do. And when I got into high school, all of that really fell by the wayside. I started experiencing mental illness and didn't know what it was. I didn't really have the education at the time to understand what I was even going through. And it was depression and anxiety at that time in the beginning of school. And I just felt crushed by it. I didn't even know how to describe it. I couldn't really put words to it, but it was just this all-encompassing thing that made me not able to function anymore. And I lost my self-esteem and my sense of self, and I couldn't concentrate in school anymore. And I kind of became the class clown rather than the high achiever. And I just hated it. I hated life. I hated experiencing it. And I tried to get help from all different areas, from counselors and doctors, and you had medications and all different kinds of things, but nothing really seemed to work. And the worst part of it was when my older brother, Chris, actually took his life when I was at my absolute worst. The exact same night I was at my worst, the first time I called Lifeline without me even knowing at the time he'd taken his life. And he and I were very close, and he seemed like the real strong one, the real brave one. He was, you know, the jock, the party boy, you know, the real larger-than-life sort of guy. And everyone tried to help as much as they could, but it still felt like there wasn't much people could really do to make that better for us. And the grief process was really hard. And there was a number of years where I couldn't even speak about it. And I just sort of shut down emotionally and went quite numb. And I think that was my way of protecting myself, my instinctive reaction. And so I ended up going to another hospital because I was really, really unwell. And in that place, I got a diagnosis which was actually correct, which is after several years of misdiagnoses. And getting on the right treatment for that really changed my life a lot. And, you know, after a number of years of talking therapy and really healing, I suppose, not sort of looking at things in terms of putting it behind me or, you know, getting over it or whatever, but really just trying to grow and heal and take the time I needed to do that, things did improve a great deal. It doesn't have to be an all-encompassing lifelong thing, but it also doesn't get better just by itself. If I didn't start getting the help and if I didn't have people around me who could really carry me at times through that, then I don't think I ever would have got better at all. And the way I try to present it is saying, well, let's just talk about it in very honest and real terms. It's not trying to inspire people and put a spin of magic on it. It's just saying, here's what mental illness really looks like. It can be really awful and really tough, and there's times of absolute misery, but also times that are just absolutely hilarious, and you know, there's real ups and downs. And the idea of it is to present it in a very honest way. So we're not talking about stats and figures and pie charts and stuff like that. We're really talking about the human experience of it and ultimately what families can do to support their children and each other, helping communities understand what supports are available in their communities too.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. With us at the moment is mental health advocate Nick Newling. I'm sure that's quite refreshing to a lot of people. What would you have said to younger you back then?
Oh, it would have been a tough conversation because I'd know what to say now, but I don't know if younger Nick would really have the patience to listen to it. But that's sort of the whole point in a way, because, you know, when I go speak in high schools to the same students who are the same age that I was when I needed to hear this message, I was dying to hear that. I thought I got so sick of these more health science messages, and I really wanted someone who'd come in and say, you know, I'm not trying to make you feel good for this hour and a half. I'm really just trying to talk about things in an honest way. I wanted that. I really wanted to get some perspective and a bit of comfort knowing that there's other people out there who are going through it as well. I'm not the only one. I'm not so lonely in all of this. But would I have actually listened to some direct advice? I think what I would have said, you don't have to be so scared of what's going to happen. I mean, it's absolutely fine if you do. You can't always control that. But I think what I'd like to give younger Nick a bit of a glimpse of is what life looks like now, where things are really well managed and I'm in a really good place. And all the things that I thought weren't going to happen, you know, like, you know, living out of home and having a job, that all has come to be. And then I've got a wonderful wife now and a beautiful little 2-year-old boy. And I think for me, I wouldn't have listened to it from anyone. I had to see it for myself.
Yeah, and getting the diagnosis would have made a big difference.
Oh, absolutely. And you can't just click your fingers and make it all happen. I was very fortunate to have people in my life who were willing to listen and were willing to understand things that they didn't instinctively understand. But that's not always the case. I think I was really quite fortunate without quite realizing at the time how fortunate I was. So I think if we can get a bit more understanding in general about the real human side of these things, then we are better able to support each other on a peer level and connect with those supports, because it really does take an understanding to appreciate that and to have more empathy for people.
Do you think also maybe just acknowledging that no one wants someone to have suicidal thoughts, but the way that we're like, you know, oh, quick, wrap this person in cotton wool, they're not allowed to do anything, they can't be trusted, that kind of fear of if you say something, you know, maybe not wanting to be alive, the ramifications feels really awful for someone in that situation. So maybe the way that we talk about suicide could change as well.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what, that's actually one of the big reasons why I held myself back from speaking about it for quite a while to my family. Is I thought, I don't want to burden them with that. I don't want to see my mum cry because what I've said to her is so distressing. And who am I to say, you know, I don't want to be alive anymore. I thought that's just such an awful thing to say to my family, even though it's absolutely honest and true. So I held myself back from speaking about it. And I think you're right, when we do have this very all or nothing approach where if someone is talking about having these thoughts of self-harm or suicide, if the response is, you know, really extreme and really dramatic, it can often rock the boat a bit. So I think it's about acknowledging that people do often have thoughts of suicide, but it can be quite different. It's not always someone's at their absolute wit's end. It may be that they're incredibly frustrated and they're going through a really tough time, and the response needs to be appropriate for the point that they're at. And I think the best way I've ever heard it described was when I was speaking at a suicide prevention conference, and another speaker like me had also had a history of having thoughts of suicide for quite a while. And she'd said that the way that people experience it is often not the way it seems to the outsider. So she said that very often people who have thoughts of suicide don't actually literally want to die. They often just want the pain to go away. And when we see our lives as being inextricably linked to pain and suffering and just, you know, feeling awful all the time, you want the life you're living to die, not yourself to actually die very often. And so I think what you're saying is absolutely right. And where that begins is having a bit of an understanding of what people are going through. And it's not saying we all need to be experts. You know, obviously doing certain things like, you know, mental health first aid training, that's all really helpful. And, you know, and plenty other suicide-specific training that can be done. But I think as a very baseline starting point, it's simply understanding the mind and the lives of people who are experiencing thoughts of suicide. Because the other part of it to think about is that, you know, yes, plenty of people who do have thoughts of suicide or even, you know, might act on it. A lot of those people do have mental illnesses, but it's also true that many of them don't. And many of the reasons that might make people have suicidal thoughts are things like financial stress. It can be social issues, whatever it might be. It's not all just mental illness. So it does take a bit of a willingness to try to understand various people's experiences.
So it sounds like Lifeline was beneficial to you. That's 13, 11, 14. That they can offer advice. They could even offer advice if you're worried about a friend and you need some help. Any other resources that you recommend?
Well, I just mentioned on Lifeline because you raise a good point. I think my understanding of Lifeline at the time was that they only do crisis support. And it just happened to be that that's when I called them. But I only came to learn a lot later that people call Lifeline for all different kinds of reasons. And it doesn't just have to be when they're at their wit's end. It can be that they're at home or anywhere really, and they're just really not feeling great. And that can be a reason to call Lifeline, even if it's, you know, many, many, many steps before they might be at their absolute wit's end. But it can also be, as you said, when you're just not sure how to help a friend. And this is something that we were discussing just a few weeks ago, doing a panel discussion at a school with Lifeline. And they said, you know, if your friend's going through a tough time and they're talking about, you know, really feeling unwell, or perhaps they're even self-harming, whatever it might be, there's no reason why you, as someone who cares about them, can't call Lifeline yourself. Or even better yet, say, you know, take the phone out. Let's say, let's call Lifeline together, put it on speakerphone and chat to someone who really understands this stuff and wants to help. Because we shouldn't have to carry the burden all by ourselves for people who are experiencing those thoughts. But as a carer, whether you want to call it a carer or a mate or whatever, but someone who's providing some assistance, it shouldn't all be on one person who's in a caring position either. They need to rely upon resources for support as well. So, yeah, Lifeline is an absolutely fantastic one. But I also want to mention another organization called Standby Support After Suicide, because I didn't know until I started working professionally in the area of mental health that there actually are services specifically for people who have lost someone they know to suicide. And I always just thought, well, you deal with it yourself. You just get through the grief somehow. Maybe you talk to a, you know, a psychologist or something like that. But to actually realize there are services that help people specifically who have lost someone in their community or in their family, and provide a whole range of services, you know, from, you know, education to just, you know, following up and checking in on people. That's a really useful thing as well, because as we know, when we do as a community lose someone to suicide, as we had in our case, people often don't know how to help. And that's something that I think in hindsight, I would have wished we had a lot more of.
Really lovely to have you on the program today, Nick. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Looking forward to being there.